Thank you for joining us this afternoon, Tuesday the 17th of November on At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick, broadcasting out of Roberta's studio in Brooklyn. And you can look at the archives for this show's segment, as well as every previous show, on the heritageradionetwork.com. And we'll start today's show with a Week in Wine recap. And in latest news in New York, millions of dollars worth of wine and spirits sold at three different auctions over the weekend have given another reason to believe that the recovery of the economy is on its way. Christie's reported nearly $3 million worth of sales, and at Sotheby's, a collection of magnums of each vintage of Vega Sicilia Unico from 1960 to 1955 sold for $102,850, five times the pre-sale estimate of $20,000. The price and demand for these wines was strengthened by the fact that they came directly from the winery. And lastly, Zaki's also showed strong with an intense bidding for a case of La Tâche Domaine de la Romanée Conti 1990, which sold for almost $41,000 or $3,400 a bottle. And in the crop report, the New York Times published an article last Friday, the 13th of November, on the state of apple brandy and apple orchards in Northern California, and how the orchards in which they come from have been seeing a steady decline with the increase of more land being given over to vineyard plantings. It discusses how apple history, and the specifically apple brandy, dates back almost as far as the wine history in California, and encourages more attention to be paid to the spirit. Thankfully, there are a handful of producers devoting attention to preserving the tradition of apple brandy, such as Germain Raben of Mendocino. The article is called A Threatened Fruit Preserved in Amber, and again, it was published on Friday, the 13th of November, so definitely worth looking into. And the Wine Spectator reports this past weekend marked the 149th Hospice de Beaune auction and charity event in Burgundy, and it demonstrated early signs of what people will pay for the new vintage 2009. Individual buyers and Burgundy wine merchants bid 20% more per barrel on average than last year, resulting in what was the second highest total at $8.1 million since the auction began in 1859, and the best results since Christie's became involved in 2005. The annual charity auction offers barrel lots produced from vineyards owned by the Hospice de Beaune, with proceeds benefiting the hospital. Prices are slightly inflated because the proceeds go to charity, but serve as a good indicator of the market mood in the French wine region. We'll be right back with an interview that I conducted last Friday with César Saldaña. Just a moment. Welcome back to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. It was a little chambao for our tribute to Spain, and more specifically Sherry, this afternoon. As I mentioned before the break, I had a moment, about an hour or so, to speak with César Saldaña, who was in town for the Secret Sherry Society event last Thursday night, as well as the Sherry Council promotioning going on in the States with respect to sherry, and had a moment to interview him at Boqueria restaurant down in Soho. So the following interview may be noisy at times due to the setup of the restaurant. However, lots of information, good information, great interview shared by César Saldaña to follow just about now.
So I'm here this morning with César Saldaña, the Director General of the Consejo Regulador from Jerez. Thank you for joining me this morning.
It's a pleasure.
I know you just came off an event last night. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the event last night was part of the Secret Sherry Society calendar of activities. Let's put it that way. We have a communication effort in the United States, which is under the umbrella of the Secret Sherry Society. It's a communication campaign trying to tell the people that there's a hidden secret in the world of wine. And that hidden secret is sherry, a wine that's been around for a long, long time, a wine that we've been producing in the south of Spain for, well, almost 3,000 years. But it's a wine that is pretty much loved by wine geeks from all over the world, but it's not much known to most of the consumers. In fact, for many people, what sherry evokes is more kind of a sweet cooking wine than mm-hmm. any other thing. So we're trying to spread the word of the reality of sherry, of the reality of this hidden secret that that only the experts know, which is that sherry is a wonderful wine, that it comes in a very broad array of styles, and that there is a style of sherry for every palate, for every moment, for every dish. Mm-hmm. And what we had yesterday was a very one of the, I mean, all the activities, all the events by the Secret Sherry Society, as you can guess, are very let's say creative.
Yeah.
And what we had was in fact our fashion show, Secret Sherry Society fashion show. We did collaboration with a charity association, which I mean it's called Fashion for Poverty. Mm-hmm. It had a great turnout. I mean, there were like 300 people there, and we all had found, many of them discovered the versatility of sherry wines for the very first time. There were a lot of young people there, and they had the opportunity to not only see great looks, but also taste beautiful sherries in different styles and try some sherry cocktails as well.
And there was an angle that you were pairing the fashion with a certain style of sherry as well to give off a certain look?
Correct. Yeah. Because, if there's anything that defines sherry is diversity, and some sherries are extremely pale in color, brilliant pale straw yellow color, and very dry, very pungent in the nose. Some of the sherries are rounder, more structured, more velvety. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And texture. So I think it was a great idea to match the different styles of sherry, the personality, the characteristics of each of the seven. We were showcasing seven styles of sherry yesterday with seven different looks, which, by the way, they were great. And
it's a fun idea.
Yeah, it was very fun. Yeah.
So the Secret Sherry Society, is this a national group or campaign?
Correct. It's one part of the efforts that we're doing here in the States. I mean, basically there are three lines that we follow. All of them converge in one same objective, but we're doing a lot of education mm-hmm. during these days, and we've done education for a long time now, but this is one of the reasons that brought me here, doing seminars and for trade people from the trade, either sommeliers or bartenders or educators. Mm-hmm. And so education is very important for us. Another part of our activity, which is also extremely important, is name protection. Unfortunately, this is one of the very few countries in the world where still the name sherry is not only using for designating the wines from Jerez, but also local producers. So name protection would be also very, very important. And then the Secret Sherry Society initiative is the consumer-oriented part of our communication efforts, let's put it that way, which is trying to create awareness about the wine, and trying to create awareness precisely among a more younger audience, people who probably don't have No. I mean, I was saying that for many people, sherry is a sweet cooking wine. Well, for young people, not even that, right? So it's kind of a virgin
starting from
target.
Square one. Yeah, yeah,
that's right. And this is where I think the idea of the Secret Sherry Society fits very, very nicely.
Which that was going to actually lead into my next question with respect to the name protection and the regulating body, as I mentioned in my introduction to you and what you do back home. Tell us a little bit about the reasoning for having a regulating body for sherry.
Well, sherry is the what they call it, denomination of origin. So it stands for a sort of collective trademark, which is used by the producers of a very precise demarcated region in southern Spain. It's the same for all the wine regions that use the denomination of origin as a collective name. When you say sherry, you're referring not just to a place, but also to a way of production. I mean, a method of production, a very elaborated, very genuine method of production, which has been perfected for throughout the centuries. And so what we try to do in that regulating body is to guarantee consumers that every bottle of wine bearing the name sherry in the label will be made by producers from that region, with mm-hmm. grapes from that region, following the very traditional and very genuine production methods that we have there, etc., etc. So
right.
It's in fact our role is a kind of a certification role, right? And we're
okay.
certifiers, and in that sense, we're not only we're very often these regulating body are often perceived as protective tools for the producers, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I firmly believe we also have a role in protecting consumers and making sure that what they get is the real stuff, right?
Has there been instances in the history in the past where there have been many producers fudging a little bit and doing things that are not by requirements within that DO?
No,
and
I mean
bottling it and selling it.
Well, one thing you have to understand is that these institutions are created by the producers themselves.
So yeah.
What they are the main interesting parties in building a reputation for the quality of the products and at the end of the day, my salary is paid by the producers. I mean, it's a privately based institution, although we are subjected to a lot of rules and regulations dictated by the government in Spain, but it's a privately owned, privately based and financed institution, and it's an initiative of the producers, of the growers. We have like 2,500 growers
mm-hmm.
in the region and about 100 different winemakers, and it's their primary responsibility and also interest to have everything under control, so that all bottles bearing the name sherry have a high quality product in it. And so, yeah, well, we also have a kind of police role, but thank goodness the attitude of the producers is very positive in that sense. I mean,
they have a lot of pride in what they're doing, and they want to make sure that they're
absolutely
representing the.
Of course, our primary, something that is really keeping us busy is to make sure that producers in other parts of the world or in other parts of Spain, although that's been within the European Union, we don't have a problem because it's legal. I mean, it's compulsory for all producers to respect the DO scheme. In other parts of the world, still we have that situation in which we have producers, local producers, calling their wines sherry. But you know, it's good because we are getting to different agreements with, for instance, in Australia, which has been very traditional to produce these this type of wines. They will be dropping the name Sherry as from 1st January. In Canada also, we've come to an agreement, and by 2012 for that they also will be abandoning the name Sherry.
What will they be calling it? Do they have yet known in other places in the world that champagne became sparkling wine, or method champagne was?
Well, it varies. For instance, in Canada, we don't know yet, but most probably they will be called Canadian fortified wines. In Australia, for instance, they have developed their own name. They call the sherry style wines that they produce Apera, from aperitif, because it's primarily dry sherries sherry style wines that they produce there. We're happy with whatever.
So that's in the 2010.
That would be 1st January 2010,
yeah.
Right?
Interesting.
And in places like South Africa, where traditional, they've been also producing port style wines, or Tokai style wines, or sherry style wines, they have they are using the name Cape. So, for instance, Cape Ruby or Cape Dry for the sort of fino style type of wines. I think it's very good, because it's important that if you have honest quality producers in those regions, it's really nonsense that they build their reputation on someone else's name, right? So exactly the same happened in Spain with the producers of sparkling wine, with the Cava producers.
Yeah.
At that time, the name that they were using was Champagne, right? But there were some producers very proud of the product they were producing, very proud of the particular style of sparkling wine, even though they were following the method Champagne was, but they had their own varieties, their own terroir, their own systems, and finally they came up with a name. At that time, it sounded a little weird to call that bottle of wine Cava instead of Champagne, because it was Champagne for us for centuries. But they decided that they needed to build a reputation of their own product, and that's the position that we support. And this is why, for instance, one of the things that we've been doing during this week has been to contact the producers of American fortified wines, I was very pleased, because they're happy to drop the port or the sherry name, but obviously they need to develop their own name, right?
Yeah. Their own identity.
Absolutely, because they're doing this very seriously and very honestly, and some of the products that they make are, some of the wines are very good. Bad, I mean, because the issue here is not about quality, it's about origin, right? They can produce a marvelous fortified wine in the port style or the sherry style or the Tokai style. Okay, the only thing is that they cannot call it either port, Tokai, or sherry, because these are geographical indications, and that would be kind of cheating the consumer.
Now, given the current climate, economically speaking, and some producers having in different parts of the world noticing exports drop, how has sherry been affected by that? I've read somewhere that actually your exports have been increasing.
Situation is tough, to say. I mean, it's not that we're not living easy times. We're very pleased because we are matching last year's figures. You're right, at the beginning of the year, shipments from Spain to the U.S. were growing. Mm-hmm. Then we had a kind of flat period. We don't have the numbers yet for the year, of course, and we're confident based on what I've talked to the different shippers, and they're happy with the prospects. But even if we just match last year's figures, I think it's quite an achievement in a context in which most of the wine regions are suffering heavy decreases in numbers. So, but anyway, we're here for the long term. I don't think our efforts or the result of our efforts should be measured in terms of what happens this
12-month
year.
Period,
yeah,
right.
That's right. We started with the Secret Sherry Society initiative like 18 months ago, something like that. Certainly, we've been doing name protection efforts and education efforts well, for much longer. But this particular communication campaign towards consumers is only, well, less than 2 years old. So I think we had to wait a little bit. We're very confident that we're doing the right things. And now we need this a little bit of consistency year on year and see where we come out.
Do you find that European cities such as Paris or London are more comfortable, or they have greater support of Sherry than somewhere like New York? Or,
well, if we look at the at our numbers and our traditional markets, certainly well, London is not London, but the United Kingdom is our primary market. I mean, we just to give you some numbers, we produce in the region of about 70 million bottles a year. About one third of everything we produce is sold in the United Kingdom. So it's always been like that because the expansion. I have to go centuries back, but the expansion of our wines in the 16th, the 7th century. We're pretty much into England, and from England, you know, to the rest of to the rest of the world. So, to a certain extent, some styles of sherries are very, you know, kind of British oriented. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Talking about the cream sherries, the sweet styles, and so UK remain a very, very
strong,
important, a key market for us, larger than Spain, larger than Spain.
We sell
more sherry in the United Kingdom that we sell in Spain. But then other European markets like Germany, Holland are very important, Belgium, practically, I mean, the whole world, because we export to Japan and Latin America and all over the place. New York is a perfect place for sherry.
Yes,
I mean, there's always that.
So is that stop where you're going somewhere on the go and you want to have a quick bite or a drink?
Absolutely.
And then there's this whole phenomenon that everyone's taking towards the grazing, sharing style plates.
Yeah.
So that also lends itself to
absolutely
food that goes well with sherry.
I think that there must be a reason for this proliferation of kind of tapas style places, because I think it fits very nicely with you know, the very alive climate that you can that you have here in the city. So yes, I think New York is a place, and in fact we see that our presence in terms of number of brands, number of distributors, number of restaurants and bars having a wide selection of sherry as well, that's definitely improving you know, constantly. So hopefully New York would be kind of central place for the expansion of sherry in this country.
Well, we're going to move into a tasting of a few different sherries, as well as a bit more of an educational explanation of the different styles.
Okay. Well, basically, I have to say that one of the things that prevents sometimes people to get into sherry wine is that it could be a bit, let's put it that way, confusing having so many styles and having so. But this is the beauty of sherry. I mean, this is the nice thing about our wines. I mean, they have a tremendous. I mean, the palette of colors and aromas and flavors is unbelievable. And let me tell you a little bit about where these all diversity is coming from, so that.
Great. We're going to take a quick break and come back. Cesar is going to tell us a bit about sherry, the different styles, and we'll do a short tasting. So we're going to move into the tasting part of today's interview. We have four different style sherries here, and I know you wanted to begin with just a background.
Okay, yeah, I think it would clarify a little bit the explanation if I say that there are, let's say, two factors that will determine all the diversity of sherry styles. One of the factors is the fermentation process, right? Basically, we have dry sherries at one end, and we have sweet sherries at the other end. The difference being not only the grape varietals that we use, the varieties that we use for this dry sherries is always the Palomino grape variety, which is a very typical grape of the area in Jerez. And then for the sweet, we use the Pedro Jimenez and Moscatel. We will process these two types of grapes differently. The Palomino, which is the one for dry sherries, we let it ferment to dryness, right? So fermentation process is complete, there's no residual sugar, and therefore this is the base for our dry sherries. Whereas in the case of the Pedro Jimenez and the Moscatel, what we do is we stop the fermentation. First, we normally sun-dry those grapes in order to concentrate the sweetness. But then we will stop the fermentation so that we keep a lot of residual sugar in the must. So that's one huge difference and first factor that will determine that we have, as I said, dry sherries on one hand and sweet sherries in the other. But then there's another factor which is extremely important for us, and that's the way we age the wines. Mm-hmm. Okay, and basically this way we age the wines will depend on the level of fortification that we give to these wines. As I'm sure you know that sherry is a fortified wine. That means that at one point in the process we will add grape spirit to slightly increase the alcoholic strength of the wine. Our wines are initially about 12% alcohol initially, but then we will increase the alcohol strength depending on what type of aging we want the wine
How do you make those decisions? How, you know, there's a point at one time where you have to say, okay, is this going to be a Fino style sherry or is this going to be an Oloroso? What are the factors that make
there are several factors and first thing I have to say is that the house styles count here, right? I mean, so you may find slightly different criteria from one house to the other, and that's something that's been probably kept for, you know, in the house for a long time. That would determine the particular style of that bodega. But the origin of the grapes is important. The process of extraction of the grape juice is very important. You will obtain a completely different wine if you just break the grapes and let the grape juice drain. I mean, it's a wine made from free run juice. Mm-hmm. Or if you press a little bit those grapes and obtain more structured grape juice, right? So that all these factors are taken into account. But at the end of the day, what really counts is the criteria of the tasters taking those decisions, the characteristics that they find in the grape juice, and later on in the young wines. So these will be the factors that will make those analogies of winemakers decide, okay, this is going to be fortified to the level that we will produce a Fino, or this will be fortified to that other level that will make us produce an Oloroso. So it's a number of different different factors. Okay. Mm-hmm. So for instance, we have here different wines, and first thing you can see is huge differences in color, right?
Yes.
So the color will be determined, said, by the type of aging. By fortifying to different levels, we either preserve a very special veil of yeast that appears in the surface of the wine that we call floor, right? At 15% alcohol, we will be able to maintain that natural element in the wine. But if we increase a little bit farther, the floor will not be able to develop. The wine will lose that natural protection from oxidation and will start getting darker in color. So that's the difference. That's what makes the difference in terms of colors. So we have, for instance, two wines. First here, one of them is a Fino, the other one is a Manzanilla. Two very similar ones, both of them very pale in mm-hmm. color. And this is because all through the aging process, they've kept that natural protection, that veil of yeasts that we call flor, which is inside the barrels, and this is what has made the wine preserve, has helped the wine to preserve the very kind of pale straw yellow color. These are ones that are aged for a minimum of 3 years, but in some cases they're aged for a long, long time, maybe mm-hmm. 20, 30 years. Finos, these wines that are so pale, usually are aged for about 5 years. Now, the interesting thing about this style of wines is that depending on where in the region you age these wines, they will get completely different aromatic notes. Okay. Right? So these aromatic notes that you have in these wines are primarily produced by the flor, by these yeast. These are wines that, as they're evolving inside the barrels, will be losing the fruitness, the original fruitness, and gaining a lot of pungency, a lot of kind of dry fruits notes, kind of almonds notes, a very typical yeasty kind of fresh dough mm-hmm. Note, and they're getting they're increasingly drier. Right? This is what we're really looking for when we make these wines, to produce a very delicate, pungent, light wine that you know, has that property of really, you know,
good acidity, very focused.
Yeah, it's very sharp, very pungent, yeah. Right?
Love it with ham.
Oh, it's yeah. great with ham. You couldn't imagine any other
better pairing than
Iberian ham and a good glass of chilled Fino. Yeah. We always serve these wines, both the Fino and the Manzanilla, which is the Fino version of the coastal town of Sanlúcar, which is one of the three towns in Jerez. Both the Fino and the Manzanilla, those very pale style sherries, need to be served very chill, mm-hmm. right? Out of a nice bucket, really, really chill, because that will enhance the freshness, the lightness, and it's a wonderful kind of not only a wonderful aperitif drink, which is probably the way in most cases Finos or Manzanilla are consumed at restaurants, but also a great wine to go, as you said, with some of the traditional Spanish tapas, and with seafood in general is
sure.
great. I love it with sushi.
Uh-huh.
It's unbelievable how it works with because that Fino has that capacity to multiply the taste, right? Alerting your taste buds and really
elevate the
threshold.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's great with that.
Great, I'll try it with sushi.
And the two wines we have here, as I said, one of them is Fino, the other one a Manzanilla. You will notice that the Fino is more kind of herbal nose, Manzanilla being a little bit more floral. In fact, the word Manzanilla means chamomile in Spanish. So it's got that very subtle chamomile flower mm-hmm. nuance, which is very, very typical. And then in the palate is a little bit lighter than the Fino.
It's a little fruitier as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, kind of green apples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know
mm-hmm.
this, but also quite a lot of almond-like notes, and definitely quite dry, delicate in the palate, and very clean. This is the reason why we drink these wines with the tapas menus, because the whole idea behind the tapas menus is going from one flavor to the other, going from Iberian ham to chorizo, yeah. and then to shrimps, and then to potato salad, and then to the nice thing about having these menus with a glass of Fino or a glass of Manzanilla is that you're cleaning your palate in every sip, right? And you're cleaning your palate, you're alerting your taste bud, you're getting your palate ready for the next step in your tapas menus. This is probably the big advantage of these wines for this way of eating.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and then we have two other wines here, which are much, much darker in color. Originally, all sherries are from white grapes, the three varietals that I have already mentioned to you, Palomino, Pedro Jimenez, and Moscatel. They're all white varieties, but depending on the aging process, the wine will get this beautiful kind of mahogany color, in some cases a little bit lighter,
amber.
Like amber color. But obviously they're gaining color with time. We have two different wines here. One of them is an Oloroso, which is still dry. I mean, a wine that it's been fermented to dryness, coming from the Palomino variety, but that we have allowed to age in direct contact with the air. I mean, we inside our barrels, we never top the barrels, right? Mm-hmm. We always allow some air inside the barrels. In the case of these very pale wines, there will be that veil that is protecting the wine from oxidation. And this is why they keep
the floor, which
the
we floor, spoke about earlier.
Correct.
Yeah.
The floor is protecting the wine from oxidation. It's a kind of a natural veil that covers the entire surface of the wine. In the case of the Oloroso, there's no protection, right? So the wine will evolve year after year.
With the contact with air.
With direct contact with air. This is the reason why it gets very heavily oxidized. It gets very much concentrated, right? It's got that powerful nose. In fact, we call it Oloroso. Because, as you know, it's the Spanish word for aromatic, powerful in the nose. But with a completely different nose to the previous wines. I mean, here the wood has a much more prominent role. You get caramels, spicy notes, like a little bit of cinnamon, a little bit of so these are a little bit of vanilla, but very subtle. So very, very kind of leather notes, which are very typical in these wines, and noble wood, a little bit of varnish, so very, very complex nose, and certainly without the pungency of the previous one.
Still very bright acidity.
Yeah, correct. And you will notice more acidity in an Oloroso than in the Fino because of the concentration. In the case of our aging process, we follow a very genuine aging process in Jerez that we call the Solera system, which is
very
a kind of fractional blending. We're getting just little quantities of the older barrels, and then we're replacing this wine that we've taken from the older barrels with wine which is a little bit younger, and then in turn we replace that with wine which is a little bit younger. So it's a kind of never-ending aging process, and at the end of that we have a wine which is in fact a blend of maybe 100 different vintages. Well, all through the process there's a permanent evaporation of some of the water, and that happens through the walls of the wood, and because of that evaporation, which would be close to 4% of the content in every barrel every year, the other components in the wine, all the acidity, even the alcohol, but also the glycerin, all the components of the wine will get what we call the dry extract will also get more concentrated, and this is the reason why these are wines with a tremendous length in the palate. They last forever. The aftertaste is tremendous, and that makes it really great also for some food. I mean, for these dry Olorosos are great with heavy meat dishes, right?
Sure.
For instance, the oxtail, these kind of Thanksgiving turkey would
definitely
be a good good idea for a glass of Oloroso. It's interesting because in our country, I mean, sherry would immediately evocate food, right?
Right.
And
you ask for a glass of white wine in many places at a tapas bar, you're getting a glass of sherry.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh. Well, particularly in southern Spain, in our country, we make wines all over the place, and of course they tend to serve their local produce. But yes, I mean sherry is very, very popular in Spain, and as I said before, it's a wine for food.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we'll finish up with this last wine.
We finish with this. This is a sweet wine. I mean, in fact, is a blend of a what we call Pedro Jimenez, which is a wine made with sun-dried grapes of the Pedro Jimenez variety, with Oloroso, right? So the color would be similar to the previous one, a little bit darker, because the Pedro Jimenez adds it's very colored, very dark mahogany wine. And in terms of aroma, again, we have that very round, very woody notes of the Oloroso, but also with nuances of raisins.
Yes.
Raisins is something that you get very strongly with the Pedro Jimenez, with this process of sun drying the grapes. And certainly you get a lot of sweetness into it. With the sun drying process, we produce wines that are as much as 400 grams of sugar per liter, so incredibly sweet. When we blend that with the Oloroso, we come to a wine of around 120 grams of sugar per liter, so it's nicely sweet, it's not cloying at all, mm-hmm. It's very fresh, with a kind of orange peel notes, quite a nice dessert wine.
Definitely, not cloying, very
not cloying,
clean
yeah,
finish.
It's quite nicely balanced. Mm-hmm. I would mention also that there's a very nice way of serving this cream sherry, which is on the rocks with a piece of orange. It's a delightful aperitif for those who do not like too dry aperitifs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a nice, mellow, very, very, very nice, fresh aperitif.
Good. Which, well, you planned a whole meal for us.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're just showcasing here four of the many, many different styles of sherry. I think it's a good selection that, for those who are interested in sherry, the adventure is endless.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for your time today. For our listeners, this is Cesar Saldana from the Secret Sherry Society and the Consejo Regulador Jerez. Mm-hmm. And look forward to your next visit in New York, and we'll continue to educate and consume here on this end in the meantime.
It'll be my pleasure.
Okay. Thanks
Salud.
So much. Salud.